Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 7 talking to authors, editors, agents, poets, those connected with the art or business of writing. Tonight my guest is Rondo Mizakowski, an award-winning Los Angeles poet and screenwriter. Rondo was a 1997 finalist at the Sundance Institute. His first screenplay, Leather Jacket Love Story, directed by David D. Coteau, saw U.S. theatrical release last February and has been the longest-running gay feature film in the history of the Lemelies Sunset 5 theaters in L.A. It's in its 17th week there. Video release is scheduled for November. Rondo has also won grants from Penn USA, West, City of Los Angeles, Transcend AIDS Artist Fellow, a 1994 Pushcart Prize nominee. His poetry has been published in the Los Angeles Times Sunday Magazine, L.A. Weekly, and Grand Passion, the Poets of L.A. and Beyond. He's a literary activist and was a guest lecturer here at UCI. And not only do I respect Rondo's work, but he's also been a friend since 1979. And I'm so glad to have you on the show, Rondo. Are you there?
Hey, Barbara. I'm glad to be here.
How are you?
Pretty good.
It's an interesting combination, being a poet and a screenwriter. And you were a poet long before you became a screenwriter. How did the screenwriting come about?
Well, it was kind of like a Hollywood story. someone called me up and asked if I wanted to write a screenplay.
How did they know about you?
I belonged to a group back then called Friends in Film, which was a gay and lesbian networking group for people involved in Hollywood or who had interest in Hollywood. Actors, directors, producers, screenwriters, lots of different people. And David Dakota, the director of Leather Jacket Love Story, and the producer, Jerry Goldberg, also belonged to Friends in Film, but I had never met them at any of the mixers. They called up Friends in Film and said, we've got an idea for a screenplay. We're looking for a screenwriter. And I was one of the names that Friends in Film gave to David and Jerry. And the rest is cinematic history.
How long did it take from making that initial contact to the movie opening?
Let's see. It took about a year to write the screenplay. David, Jerry, and I, we all had other jobs. So we'd meet. It was David's idea. I'd write some pages. They'd give me some notes. You know, I'd write some more pages, more notes. And it went back and forth. It took about a year. And then it took about, 2-3 years to try to raise money for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was difficult, as it always is for independent films.
Mm-hmm. How was the process? I mean, being a poet and now being thrust into Hollywood and screenwriting and dealing with, I guess decisions by committee. How did the process work for you?
Well, it's very different than writing poetry, different than writing fiction, even different than writing plays. It's really a collaborative process. As I told you, we get notes back and forth, so even from the very beginning, my words were being, changed and ideas were brought in, and that's very good, in lots of ways, because Jerry and David had great ideas, and the really wonderful thing about filmmaking is it is such a collaborative process. Everyone brings something into it, the actors, the set designers, the people working on sound, and it's really nice that way. I'd recommend that if you're a poet and you're interested in screenwriting, but if you can't stand to have one comma of your poem changed, don't do it. Save everyone a lot of grief.
What's the one quality that you do need to be able to be a screenwriter?
Well,
is it that enjoying the collaborative process? Is it loving movies?
Those things are all part of it. I know my particular training as a poet was a great help for me as a screenwriter because I was able to write short descriptive scenes in just a few words
mm-hmm.
because that's what poetry is.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big help. I know other screenwriters, they admire that. It's like, wow, look at that image. Yeah, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really big help.
Hmm. Just, going into poetry, but what drew you to poetry? Because you've been a poet a long, long time.
Yeah, I guess since about the eighth grade or so.
Wow.
It was just, I really liked it. It was a neat way of looking at the world. And looking at the world and trying to come to some sort of, understanding of it.
Mm-hmm.
you know, whether with an image or I guess in a way trying to like make it mine.
Hmm. Would you read a poem?
I would love to. I'm going to read a poem from many, many years ago. It's called Snow, and which we rarely see much of in Southern California. Snow. You wake up and the air has that special light you've seen before. So you pull up the window shade and it's true. It snowed last night. The radio said it was going to and the paper said so too. But you know, they're hardly ever right, especially when you live way out here at the end of the world. You get out of bed and do a little dance, the first snow of the season dance. And then you figure out what to wear. You want to be prepared for this. You think of long underwear, but decide against it. You like the feeling of the cold licking against your legs now, even though you won't be able to stand it in January. You put on shirts and pants and socks and three sweaters, and you feel dizzy because you're top-heavy. You need boots to sort of balance yourself out, but that third sweater was too much. You can't bend down to tie your boots, and you're getting impatient and warm as you look out the window. It's so delicious. The snow is still falling. It'll wait for you. So you take off the extra sweater and tie your boots on and your gloves. Where are they? You know you put them somewhere last year, somewhere where you wouldn't forget them when the first snow came. But of course, you forgot where that place is. You wouldn't forget. And you have to root around in closets and desks. You need your gloves. How can you make snowballs if you don't have your gloves? And finally, you open the bottom drawer of the last dresser, and there are your summer shorts. So many shorts you never knew you had, even the pair you couldn't find all last summer, the ones that show off your nice legs. And you put those shorts off to the side, making a mental note to remember them for next summer. But how do you make a mental note anyways? You imagine a notepad or a piece of paper or a ledger marked clothes to remember and your brain trying to hold a pen as it scribbles hot looking summer shorts here and you're sure you'll remember where you're putting them this time and under the shorts and tank tops and bathing suits and t-shirts. How do you ever get this many clothes? There are your gloves scrunched up in a corner right where you put them. You remember now how you always get like this for the first snow, just so excited like the big kid you are, and finally you're all dressed and you open the door. Step outside and breathe.
Thank you, Rondo.
Oh, thank you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM, Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with poet and screenwriter Rondo Mizakowski. What skills that you have as a poet helped you be a screenwriter? You mentioned earlier just, you know, being able to write concisely and you know, being able to nail an image or a feeling, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are real handy because the first thing that a screenplay is, even though it's, you know, it's going to be turned into a film, is it's a reading experience for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I wrote Leather Jacket Love Story, there were things I wrote in it which didn't make it to the final film, but people read it and it's like, wow, that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's a neat image. I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes the screenplay itself attractive, and it's a fun read.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people want to read it. You know, and if it's boring, if it's not exciting, then people aren't going to read past 10 pages.
Right, so it's making the screenplay interesting for the reader.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And poetry, I think, is fascinating. You know, just the different ways it can be written, the different images, the different things you can pull up for the reader.
Hmm. What in life helps you to write poetry? What do you turn to? What inspires you?
Well, you know, it really varies, and it's really varied over the years. Like the snow poem. I mean, obviously, that's just the first snow, and that was just one sort of little image, one sort of little instance. I was trying to find my gloves to go out and play in the snow years ago when I lived on Cape Cod, and I couldn't. You know, and that just kind of stuck with me, and there are images, like, from childhood and things that, you know, stay with me for years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, now decades. And I just kind of hold them and just play with them, and eventually something comes about.
Are there any poets you especially favor?
I love Yeats, you know, William Butler Yeats,
mm-hmm.
and contemporary poet Louise Gluck.
Mm-hmm.
She's really wonderful. A whole series of flower poems called The Wild Iris,
mm-hmm.
which I think is really, really nice, where the flowers actually talk. And they're not necessarily nice flowers. time. Which is nice. That's a neat little twist on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's definitely not sentimental.
Mm-mm.
Would you read another of your poems?
Sure. Let me read. I'm doing a series of flower poems, and this one is called Elephant's Ear. Ripped skin of lemon drifts from my garden to my home. Now an orange scent, the citrus tang of both, but tinged with vanilla. The couple, now dead, who lived here before me, planted the elephant's ear. It floats a fleet of offspring through the shaded soil, leaves big as sails, unfurls dreamily under my open windows. I'm writing Christmas cards, pushing through my address book. So many dead, names crossed out, quick pen strokes slash the pages. I didn't think it could blossom. Golden pistils like children's fingers poke out of creamy flowers. I take another breath. New addresses bloom in pencil.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a series I'm working on of AIDS poems, because
mm-hmm.
I've lost, you know, many, many, many friends to AIDS, as many people have.
Mm-hmm.
And as a poet, I just felt, well, I had to write about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've written different ways, and now it's... You can tell that's kind of a different poem than the snow poem.
Right.
I mean, not that it's just one's funny and one's somber, but now I've just found myself, I'm slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm really, like, trying to focus on very individual details and all the power, you know, just an image, you know, just a small picture.
Mm-hmm.
While snow was just to, like, more like a blizzard. You just try to get everything in, just
mm-hmm.
very stream of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that. That's kind of connected with you being a literary activist. You were the founder and series coordinator of the 1992-1993 Me and HIV Nation's only reading performance series exclusively featuring HIV-positive artists of Being Alive, people with HIV-AIDS Action Coalition, L.A. How do you see yourself as a literary activist?
Gosh, someone told me I was that one. I just kind of stuck. I thought, oh, that's cool. I also worked at the Gay Men's Writers Series at a Different Light bookstore in Los Angeles, and originally Different Light was in Silver Lake. And it had moved to West Hollywood, and there was a void in the neighborhood. You know, it was the reading series was no longer happening, but Being Alive was here, and I approached Ferd Egan. There Being Alive, and I said, hey, let's do a series. You know, and he said, that's cool. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to bring people just different voices and mix it up, have all different kinds of people, you know, reading their work. And, some people played guitar, and some people did fiction, nonfiction, poetry, pieces of plays, pieces of nonfiction. And I think it's really important just to hear different voices and to provide a forum for people to speak, and to people to share their lives.
Mm-hmm. You've said that if you're going to write poetry, it's important to get out of yourself and to live life and to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
Would you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. I think volunteering is really important. What I've seen is so many people, and I've been guilty of this, especially when I was younger, I would write lots of poems about writing poetry. And I think it was, you know, I really hadn't lived life yet. You know, my original writing teacher, Diane Wachowski at Michigan State University,
mm-hmm.
had really recommended, don't go to get an MFA. You know, go out and live life. And I left Michigan and moved to San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great. It was a wonderful experience for me just to be on my own and to meet lots of different people. In fact, that a lot of that experience, it was put into Leather Jacket Love Story. You know, and I think to get out of yourself, especially important for writers, you know, and especially people in Hollywood, go out and do different things. You know, volunteer, help other people. You know, I work with a group in Los Angeles called Give, which is part of Kashi Foundation. And, you know, we feed homeless people once a month. You know, go out, make up some meals, and take it out to, you know, a bunch of people in Los Angeles. And it's great.
Hmm.
You know, because then it's not just about me. You know, it's not just about me, not just about my writing. And I think it's important for writers to have really wide experiences. you know, as many different things. You know, and I think volunteering is wonderful for that. Mm-hmm. You know, to get people out of themselves. You know, and hang out with other people besides writers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even though writers like really understand what you're going through, you know, and I think it's helpful to, you know, belong to writers' groups and socialize with writers. I don't think it's good to do that exclusively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because then you're going to be writing about writers.
Read another poem. I want more of your poems.
Okay. Let me read, I'll read another one from that series. That's what I'm working on now. The series is called Under the Tree of Heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I think I'll read that poem.
Okay.
It's called Ailanthus, Tree of Heaven. Outside the hospital window, a grove of ailanthus strive up out of the city's brick, their leaves pointed teeth, branches skinny as bone. Inert, you lie on the bed, tubes a tangle snaking out of your chest and mouth. Your right hand curls, then straightens itself. Like an umbrella, the ailanthus shields your hospital room with a canopy of creamy green, steamy in the humidity that cannot touch us behind protecting glass. Out there, it's a jungle, like the ones you visited on Sarawak or the Celebes, a fecund green that doesn't quit, like the ever-sprouting ailanthus that kept declaring itself the length of my family's house despite my mother's tries at burying it, broken stone poured out of a wheelbarrow, a white plume of dust ghosting my mother. Above her best efforts, taller than our house, an older ailanthus spread shade, host to cicadas whose screams pierced our living room. Every year, iridescent Japanese beetles crawled like slow jewels, devouring my mother's roses. Scarlet Queen, American Beauty, peace. Your feet twitch under the thermal blanket. It's getting colder in here. Your hand continues to slowly fold and unfold. I take it. It's icy. In the green light of the Tree of Heaven, the respirator hisses.
Hmm. Gosh. Let's talk about your process a bit. How do you work? Do you... The image comes, the poem comes, and do you put it through a number of drafts before you feel that it's done? Do you at some point read it to others and see if they think it's there? How do you work?
Yes, all of the above. Usually there's an image. There's something. And ailanthus, the part about my mother and the ailanthus growing next to us, I mean, that's all true.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in Ohio. But I was out one night, and I saw an ailanthus tree growing up. And they're the type of tree that don't do well in good soil. They like rock. They like stone.
Hmm.
You know, they're a very big urban tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw one growing up at night, and it was up against the black sky with the green leaves, you know, the sticking out like teeth. And that just kind of stuck with me. And I spent about a few days in the library looking at the ailanthus because I had remembered a story I had read about the trees in like a Smithsonian magazine or something like that. So I did all this research, you know, on it. and then I just started thinking about that, remembering different people who I visited in the hospital. It just kind of forms itself. I usually bring it to a writer's group, once I bring it again to a writer's group. A lot of work is usually done before the poem actually gets on the page, but then once it's on the page, I usually do, drafts. I go into double digits.
Mm-hmm.
I usually do at least 11 drafts once it's on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And then other things will change, you know, over the years. You know, I mean, change a word or two.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like your poems come more from images versus, say, feelings.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
So why is that? Are feelings too abstract, you think, or, well, I don't know.
I don't know. For me, an image stays with me such a long time that it kind of, like, carries a... It becomes a feeling in a way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that image. I mean, this is like a conglomeration of images, you know, remembering the cicadas, you know, from the youth, you know, just screaming out in the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I don't know, just kind of like floating around my consciousness. And then I saw this other Atlantis a few years ago here, and just kind of pulled things up. And I'm working on this series of flower ponds, so now whenever I see anything vegetable, you know, I think, maybe that's part of the series.
Mm-hmm. Is this series of flower poems going to become a chapbook?
I hope so, but it becomes a book.
Uh-huh.
I'm putting it together and playing around with it. I've had good luck publishing the individual poems. So that's what makes me feel like I'm onto something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm working on another poem about lamb's ears. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that plant. It's like a silver fuzzy.
Yes. Is it something you can read?
No, but I'm just kind of playing with it.
Okay. Do you have another
one? Last couple weeks. Here's one of my favorite flowers. It grows up on a silver stalk and
mm-hmm.
a bright purple flower
mm-hmm.
on the tip, which kind of reminded me of Kaposi's sarcoma stalk.
Mm. Interesting.
You know, the idea of lambs and people as sheep. And, you know, the leaves are so fuzzy and really, they're tactile. You want to, like, touch them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just kind of like lambs on the way to the slaughterhouse, you know, chewing on each other's ears or something.
Mm.
Like a touch, you know, how, you know, face to face, how people, you know, even though things look bleak, will still reach out and, you know, make contact with other people.
Mm-hmm. Rhonda, do you have another? You can read?
This one is called Sacred Datura, which is another name for that flower, is Angel's Trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
These horns of heaven hang down heavy in the garden beyond your sick room, trumpeting their weight of white. Crowding the window above your head, they form a floral halo as you open your mouth. This is my body, the priest intones, while his fingers tender bread to your tongue. Your eyes roll back in your head. Glory, glory, the flower scent issues, promising nectar. Ambrosial aroma tugs toward the garden. Your mouth is still open. This is my blood. The wine spatters a red trail on your sheet. You swallow easily. I wish I could hear the blare of horns or the sweet speech of angels as you do. I watch the perfect blossoms fall like a massacre outside your window. Flowers, you, just the wings, you are sure, even now, sweet earthward for you.
Hmm. I like these poems.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with them. And just a lot of the alliteration and just, they're real heavy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
sure.
Again, it's not just the theme, but it's, you know, it's really focusing on the tiny details, like, you know, the fingers of the priest, you know, giving the host mm-hmm. to the dying person.
Mm-hmm. Rhonda, do you have any words of advice for blossoming poets?
Read a lot. Go to lots of readings. Read your work aloud. Don't forget to do that. That's always a big test for me. You know, I write, and I read my work aloud, and I go, ooh.
Read aloud to yourself.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, ooh, that line needs more work. It becomes really clear.
Mm-hmm.
Go out, you know, like I said before, you know, volunteer, help somebody get out of yourself. You know, because the important thing is to have a good life, is to have a full life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being a writer, you can do that. It's possible, but, you know, being a writer isn't the only thing in your life,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that's really important. You know, cultivate other interests, cultivate other friends, you know, and help other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's the real key.
Hmm. Well, it's been just such a great pleasure to have you with us tonight, and thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And happy birthday. It's your birthday tomorrow.
Yeah. I'm going to be 42.
Oh, happy birthday.
I thought it was going to be 43, and then someone said, well, you were born in 56. Yeah. Well, you're going to be 42.
Oh, okay.
And another year.
Yay. Well, thank you. And, you've just been listening to Rhonda Myskowski. Look for his name. He gives signings around L.A. His soon.
Oh, thanks, Barbara.
All righty. Bye-bye, Rhonda.
Bye-bye.
Join us next week when San Francisco literary agents Michael Larson and Elizabeth Pomata will be my guests. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. If you need to reach me, fax me at 760-1443. Thanks for listening, and get to work. Remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.